Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. I just want to say hello to everyone out there, and I hope you're snuggled up somewhere nice and warm. I want to take just a moment. I don't usually do this, but today I had both the honor and the burden of saying a eulogy for our very dear Dr. Tom Barker, ear, nose, and throat physician in town, well beloved by both the patient and the medical community alike. Dr. Tom was a real doctor's doctor, smart and extremely compassionate. He was a wonderful man, a righteous human being, and I just want to take a moment to give him a shout out of respect. And I want to start by giving you a little Zika update. It's here, as the little girl in Poltergeist said, the first time in the United States we've documented a case of Zika virus in a person who hadn't been to Mexico and hadn't, as far as she knows, had any active sexual contact with anyone who had. This woman was not pregnant, and the reason that she was checked was she lives down in Brownsville, Texas, right near the Mexican border, and they found Zika's genetic thumbprint in the woman's urine. The urine test is turning out to be very accurate. It was not in her blood. I find that interesting that people carry an imprint in their urine long after they've carried it in the blood. And Texas officials are now recommending that any pregnant woman in southern Texas, Texas has fever plus rash or fever plus joint pain, joint pain plus rash, basically any of three symptoms, eye redness, joint pain, itchy rash, and fever. And anyone statewide in Texas, or for that matter, anyone who's traveled anywhere near the Southwest who has three of those symptoms should probably get tested. The CDC has confirmed as of November 23rd, we have 4,444 cases in the United States, and most of those are from people who were traveling, but we have 182 that were from local spread. And the preliminary results are in, because we've had enough Zika cases now to do a pregnancy registry, and we have enough pregnancies. We have 442 completed pregnancies among women with laboratory evidence of Zika virus, and birth defects occurred in 26 fetuses, and 22 of those had brain abnormalities, with or without microcephaly. So we're going to assume that those brain abnormalities, for the sake of our argument, are a birth defect related to Zika, and that works out to about 5%. Now, when they looked into this more carefully, what they saw was that the pregnancies that where the infection could be linked to early pregnancy did much worse, and so the risks in those pregnancies were much higher. We are looking at a very interesting biological phenomenon. It's not so interesting if you live in mosquito zone, and it'll be very interesting to see whether the Zika virus turns out to be the first use of the CRISPR-altered mosquitoes. CRISPR's been in the news a lot lately. I've been following this story for a couple of years, and it's really fascinating. Just like your word processor, you can highlight something and cut it and then paste it into a different paragraph. You can do that with your email when you're composing. Well, we are now at the point where we can do that within DNA. We can cut out a place in DNA. We can also put something in. So in the case of the gene drive, what we can put into the DNA, amazing as it sounds, is we can put in, first of all, the DNA to copy the gene drive again so that it's going to spread through all of the cells in that organism. And we can put in, well, in this case, let's say we put in a gene that makes those mosquitoes, those male mosquitoes, infertile. Well, that wouldn't work. What about if we make the offspring of the male mosquitoes infertile? Oh, well, that starts to look good. What about if we make the offspring a lethal mutation? Well, then we can wipe out we can literally wipe out the mosquito as long as those mosquitoes breed before that lethal mutation kicks in. We can drive this across a population and drastically reduce the numbers of mosquitoes. It might even be possible to find a way to make mosquitoes unable to transmit Zika or unable to transmit. Then we would be taking, well, take your disease, dengue, malaria, we'd be taking them off the table, but doing it without a way that affected the food supply of the other insects. Now, that starts to look like some really careful ecological engineering, and, well, we can do it. The question is, are we smart enough to do it right? And I don't know the answer to that, but I think I'm going to find out. My next story is something useful. One of the things that we find in older patients when we do any kind of major surgery is post-operative delirium. This is a major complication where the person does not come back to normal consciousness. They may act psychotic. They may be hallucinating. These are people who have to be restrained. Sometimes they don't recover enough to go home. They may end up at a nursing home. And you can basically think of delirium as a messed up brain. And the older you are, the less able your body is to deal with the major shock of a major surgery. In fact, in people over the age of 70 undergoing major surgery, that's 76 for this particular study, the frequency of delirium is 1 out of 5 people. And this can be a really, really difficult situation medically and leads to a lot of readmissions and also excess mortality and problems with getting people back from that surgery. So the rest is pure opinion, no science, but that's because it's hard to research. The basic principles are so, well, basic and fundamental to medicine that I think I can confidently give you this advice. If you're in that older age group, particularly if you have a history of reactions to pharmaceuticals, there's a couple of things you should be doing prior to your surgery, leading up for a couple of weeks, especially if it's an elective surgery like a hip replacement or a knee replacement. You should be watching your nutrition and your hydration very carefully. You should get some fiber on board. You should get yourself pooping regularly. You should have plenty of fluid. You should be eating plenty of protein. And you should be taking liver support agents. A couple of good supplements that come to mind are alpha lipoic acid and milk thistle. And you want to take these for a couple of weeks before your surgery, but stop the week before your surgery, because you don't want to do anything that's going to interfere with clotting. And for some individuals, even though these are excellent agents, they can slow clotting slightly. Not as much as fish oil, and you definitely want to stop your fish oil, Motrin, and aspirin for a couple of weeks before major surgery. The other thing you want to do is walking. Now, when you are post-operative, one of the things we want to do as early as possible is mobilize you. If you're delirious, we can't let you out of bed. And so that's a big issue. So no junk food. Clean up your diet for a week. Stay away from alcohol. Get an extra fruit and vegetable powder. You can pick that up at the health food stores. Trader Joe's has them. Because the fruits and vegetable compounds contain things that are going to help your liver burn through those agents that are used for anesthesia. Might even take a couple of warm Epsom salt baths leading up to your surgery. That helps detoxify, which means that your liver will have no backlog. It'll be ready to jump on and process those chemicals, very important chemicals, but we want them out of your body pronto. And these are the ways to do it. Oh, and by the way, I did mention bowel movements. Psyllium, which is the basis of Metamucil, but you can get psyllium seed at any health food store in bulk, and it's quite cheap that way. You want to be having big BMs. Big BMs before surgery means that you are going to have a better, easier post-operative recovery. It's time to go to an email. And I had a really interesting couple of emails from two different individuals, Dan in Thompson and Bob in Fort Lauderdale, both sent me an article that was published just recently and made NPR and a couple of other places. Comparison of hospital mortality readmission rates for Medicare patients treated by male versus female physicians. And the upshot of this article, published in JAMA Internal Medicine, you can look at the online abstract. It's December 19th. Do outcomes differ was the big question, and what they saw was that the adjusted mortality for people was a little bit less if you had a woman physician. Now, these were patients who were admitted to the hospital who had no choice of which doctor was going to be assigned to them. These were internal medicine physicians. And what they found was that the mortality rate, death rate, was 11% for those who had female physicians and 11.5% for those that had the female, the male physicians. So, you know, half of a percentage more. It's not a really big deal, except if you happen to be that 1 out of 200 that is the excess mortality. Also, they saw the same trend for readmission rates, about half a percentage point. Fewer people had to be readmitted to the hospital with complications. Now, they didn't study the differences. And when I first read about this, my question was, did they control for age? Because at this point, there's a really interesting thing about the ages of a group of physicians. If you say doctors who are 35, you're going to find that about 50% of physicians who are 35 years old are women. If you say doctors who are 60, well, you're going to find that about 5% of the doctors who are 60 are women. And given that medicine moves quickly and it's hard to keep up, you could make the argument that older doctors might have a slightly higher mortality rate in their patients simply because they're having trouble dealing with these crazy computer medical record system, or possibly because they don't follow guidelines quite as strictly because they aren't checking them because they think they know them. Both ideas are possible. I'm not one to imply any kind of overt or covert ageism and sexism here. What I would say we need to do with this data is not go looking at women doctors, but first of all, let's replicate it in the outpatient community. Let's see if it crosses other specialties. I'd particularly be interested to see whether it makes any difference in surgery, because I suspect the difference may shrink in surgery. Most importantly, if there is a real difference between male and female doctors, then we need to figure out what women are doing differently and make that a best practice for medicine. Not point fingers, not blame, but build. I want, when someone's doing a better job than me, I want to know how are they doing it and how can I clone it? Because that's the secret sauce. Always better, always trying to meet our patients' needs. We're going to take our first call. Is Linda in Felton? Hello, Linda.
Well, hi. I'm very glad that you took my call. I was listening to your show, and I just got out of Dominican Hospital. I was there for 16 days.
Wow.
And I had congestive heart failure. I'm 68 years old. And I wanted to answer your question about a male versus a female doctor, just my opinion.
Your experience, yes, I'd love to hear it. Go ahead.
Okay, what I have found, well, what I found, the last hospitalization, which was just recently, it was right before Christmas, was that I had both male and female doctors. I'd never had congestive heart failure before, and so I didn't have a doctor. But what I found when I was there was that all the doctors were very attentive. They all seemed very knowledgeable. But the female doctors were far more compassionate. They just seemed to, when they came in, they were more personable to me. And it made me feel like a person versus a number. And so that's the main thing that I found to be the difference.
Well, can you remember, take a second and think, what were the actions or the speech, or what was it that made those women doctors more personable?
Well, one of the things when they came in, they were always smiling. They would take the chair and pull it up next to my bed, and the female doctors would take my hand. The male doctors, a lot of them would come in like they were in a hurry and didn't even sit down.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I found that I gained much more from the female doctors that came in because they were going to take the time to explain things to me. Whereas the male doctors seem to think, well, you know, see, I'm a psychiatric social worker, and so they're thinking, well, you know, I don't know about medical stuff. And so it was kind of like they'd skip over it and just kind of not even, they wouldn't even tell me when they were going to change medications. Where wow. The female doctors would come in, explain what they were doing, why they were doing it, and so I gained the knowledge because I have to live with this for the rest of my life.
Well, Linda, thank you very much for the call. I want to share one experience with you before I let you go. When computers came in, I had always, up until that point, made a point of exactly that. When I'm in clinic, but when I walk into the room, sit down, and then, you know, just look at the patient. I would have a clipboard in my in my lap, and I could make notes, but I could make that eye contact. And when the computers came in, this would have been the early 2000s that we started using them up at Scotts Valley, it really got in the way of that human contact. And I'm not suggesting we can possibly get rid of computers. I mean, we're not going to be able to go back there.
Right.
But I just
but
we're in the Silicon Valley, so I just want to kind of put it out there to developers and other people that to the extent that we can have that, sit down, make eye contact, we're both in this together, that clinical alliance, I believe, is invaluable. And you just, you know, called in and made one of my points for me. So thank you so very much.
You're welcome.
Have a good day.
And thank you for your
sincerely hope for your continued not being in the hospital. Have they got you weighing yourself every day?
Yes, they do.
Good. That just
and
for,
I,
yeah.
And the doctor that the cardiologist that I picked is a woman.
Well, let's go girls, huh?
You're right.
All right. Thank you so much for the call. Promised you something practical, so here's another practical one. Fiber may play a role in lessening knee pain, and not just knee pain, but osteoarthritis development. This was a study done and reported at the annual College of Rheumatology last month or 2 months ago now, and published online in Arthritis Research and Care. And what it shows is that the more fiber you ate over 4 to 8 years in a prospective multi-center trial, so they looked at 5,000 men and women age 45 through 79 with or at risk with knee osteoarthritis. They recruited them back in 2004, followed them for 4 to 8 years, and they looked at their amount of dietary fiber and divided it up into four groups, lowest quarter, next lowest, highest quarter, next, and the one down from that. So in the group with the highest amount of fiber compared to the group with the lowest amount of fiber, there was a really stunning difference in the likelihood of severe pain, with 44% lower likelihood of severe pain in the individuals with the highest fiber intake. And they also found that the progression of osteoarthritis was slower, but they were using pain scores in this study because that's something that's been validated and is very objective, as objectivity goes, compared to having people read an x-ray, and you can measure the amount of cartilage loss, and that's a pretty good indicator. So when you see that fiber is causing cartilage loss to occur more slowly, or when people are reporting that, when the high fiber group is reporting that they have less knee pain with from their arthritis, well, that's something that we all need to take a look at. And I was talking earlier about the importance of fiber in order to have regular bowel movements, to clear out the toxins. And here's another reason, and I don't think it's just because people who eat regular fiber are that much lighter. And I'm going to pop to a couple of emails. This one from Dan in Salinas. And Dan writes, ketamine for treating peripheral neuropathy. Hello, I'm a 63-year-old living in Salinas, recently diagnosed with low-grade lymphoma, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and I have very severe peripheral neuropathy in my feet. I'm a very active person, but now I can barely walk 10 feet without severe pain, burning, pressure, numbness, and the feeling of 1,000 bee stings. I'm taking gabapentin and tramadol with very little relief. My oncologist has not heard of ketamine infusions, which I was reading can help with neuropathic pain. Is this something that might work for me? Well, Dan, ketamine's a really interesting agent, and it has also been used, interestingly enough, in severe depression intravenously, and shows promise for the treatment of that. It acts on the cell membrane of neurons, and so it has a profound effect in the brain and can be used as a sort of anesthetic. It can also permeate the skin. So I use ketamine creams in my practice for patients with peripheral neuropathy, and I've had good luck with that. An infusion with ketamine is a little more risky because of the dosing, and it's generally done in a very controlled setting, but you should be able to get a referral to a pain clinic or a pain specialist. And that would be a really excellent reason perhaps to go up to our great resource, which is the Stanford Pain Clinic. I've sent patients there and had very good results in terms of creative and innovative research methods that have been used to help my patients. And also I've had failures. So there's no guarantee that a particular clinic is going to save the day. But I do want you to think about asking for that referral. And also, our own Loudon Pharmacy here in Santa Cruz on 41st Avenue, you can look them up. They will send your doctor an information sheet on how to order a ketamine cream. And these things can be compounded and mailed to you. You don't even have to get on the freeway. So go ahead and ask your doctor to reach out, or go online to the website, the Loudon Pharmacy website, and I think it's loudonpharmacy.com, but I'm not certain, but just Google search it. And they will be able to send that to your doctor, and you'll get yourself some help. Don't worry. And if those things don't work, well, then you email me back, and we'll keep trying till we find something. Okay, and we're going to go to our next caller, and that is Joe. Hello, Joe.
Hi. I have a question. I had a gallbladder surgery about a few years ago, about 3 years ago, and it was complicated surgery. And since then, I've been having a lot of back pain, upper abdominal pain and back pain.
Okay.
Not sure what to do about that. But
is it on the same? Is it on your right side, the back pain?
Yes.
Okay.
It's not originally from right side. But extends to the upper back, lower back.
Does it go all the way up to the shoulder on the right?
Meet the scapula.
Okay. So that could be referred pain from the area around the diaphragm, right where the gallbladder is a little low. It's under the liver. you know, when people have gallbladder attacks, that pain will sometimes refer to the top of the shoulder. So we do watch for that. There's a number of possibilities. Let me ask a few more questions. Is there any connection with eating? Does the pain change, for example, after a meal, or if you have fried food in particular, do you get any increase in the pain?
Sometimes, but it tends to be now I'm waking up with it.
All right. And have you tried things like Mylanta, Maalox, basic antacids for it when it's bad?
No, I haven't yet.
Okay. So for the few things that you have to look at is, as a doctor, when we're doing this sort of thing, and remember, you know, you should be seeing a doctor if this persists, but there's a whole long list. And so I'll kind of run through the list for you in terms of what I would consider to be the highest order of probabilities. First of all, you got to worry about duodenitis, which is an irritation of the duodenum from too much acid or coming out of your stomach, because that's the most common, that's one of the most common causes of pain in that area. Your gallbladder is gone, but if you can't store or make enough bile in your bladder to cover a fatty meal, you could be getting pain from trying to digest fat. But that's not going to be happening in the middle of the night, so I'd put that one down a little lower on the list. Scar tissue can cause pain, and that pain in the area of the upper abdomen. If it's scar tissue pain, it generally will be worse when something moves your guts around. So that could be physical positioning, twisting, bending, leaning backwards, or when your guts are trying to digest food. So again, the question of how does this pain relate to meals? The pain in the middle of the night definitely makes me think more about something mechanical, like back pain, something that's completely has nothing to do with your gallbladder surgery, that they're just both occurring, except that they're both occurring in the same body. And back pain at night, I don't want to put a ghost in your head, but I will generally, if it's just back pain at night, I want, and it gets better, you know, if you get up and walk around, I want that person checked for a cancer in the spine. It's a rare thing for it to show up that way, but if you have any cancer history or, an x-ray at least of the back might be not such a bad idea, looking for any kind of rattiness of the bones. And you need to be checked out physically and have somebody move you around so that you can really see what's going on.
I see.
Okay.
I see.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah. So get someone, first of all, push on where it hurts in the front, and see if pushing on anywhere in the front makes it hurt in the back, and then that would definitely connect the dots.
But it also, as you mentioned, now that I'm thinking, when I do eat, it tends to be like a few hours after I eat, I'm start getting like spasm in the back. So I think it also deals with some digestive issue.
All right, so I have a try for you. Go out to the health food store and get some bile. Usually you can get ox bile capsules.
Ox bile.
Go get some ox bile capsules and take about 1,000 milligrams of that with a meal that's a fairly heavy fat meal.
Okay.
And, you know, see how that goes. But if it's like better, you probably want to do the same meal twice, and do it once with and once without. And if it's better with the ox bile, then we may have your solution right there. You're not making enough bile anymore because you can't store it. And,
right.
And your liver can't pump it out fast enough, and so you're just getting problems from undigestible fat.
I see.
So I hope it's that. That's like a super easy fix. So that one would be safe to try.
Awesome. Thank you very much. I appreciate your taking my call.
Well, you're very welcome. And remember, don't sit on this too long. If you can't find the answer, go see somebody, okay?
All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. Okay, we're going to take one more call, and I think we're going to talk now to Richard. Hello, Richard. Have we got you?
There you are. Yes, please.
Okay.
Hold on. I just wanted to say real quick, you had somebody call in about peripheral neuropathy. I know a few things about that. I wanted to mention the medicine called Lyrica, and I was just wondering whether you have had much experience using it.
Oh, quite a bit, yes. I think that email, yes, he said he was on gabapentin. Lyrica is pregabalin. It's pretty closely related to gabapentin chemically, and they act in the same way. Lyrica's quite a bit more expensive, so we usually try to get people on gabapentin, and if they fail that, we may, if we've got them, try them on some Lyrica samples. And if that works, then we can write a letter to the gods of pharmacology, that is to say, the high school graduate who's reading the letters that we doctors send begging for medications from the insurance companies, and try and get try to get the drug approved. I think it's an okay agent. What was your question?
My question is, it's kind of there's another issue that I have. For some reason, that maybe it's anxiety or something, but I seem to be swallowing air, and that disturbs my whole GI, you know, going on. Then I think it's should it be anxiety? I don't know. I just find myself swallowing air, and I know there is a medicine that my doctor gave me a while back, and I was just wondering, do you know why we do? I know every time you chew a piece of food, and maybe that seems to be a biofeedback mechanism about how much food you're supposed to eat. And I think it's how much air you actually swallow each time you chew. And I was just wondering, you're really smart. And I was wondering to ask you about that.
If you look it up, there's actually a word for this. It's called aerophagia. And it means in Latin air swallowing, because, you know, Latin sounds much cooler than English. And it is related to anxiety, and it can be, because when you're trying to breathe slowly, take deep breaths. And then there's a moment there where you can swallow at the top of that inhalation, and you can fill your stomach up. It's also really common if people are eating quickly or talking and laughing while they're eating and not chewing and just kind of gobbling. So the old chew everything 20 bites, and if you sing like a little bar of a song to yourself while you're chewing, like Mary had a little lamb, it's got, et cetera. And by the time you get to white as snow, you can swallow. And try that a couple of times when you first sit down to eat, to establish a rhythm. And it's really important if you're talking, you know, that's really why you're not supposed to talk with your mouth full, is so that you don't swallow air and choke. And the other thing is running. If you are exercising, it's easy to get into the habit of swallowing air when you exercise. And I don't know if that is you, if you're an exerciser, but that's definitely something to check for.
Can I ask you one more quick question?
Sure, one quick one.
Yeah. What I know is you're never supposed to use maybe alcohol, but it seems to be a muscle. It is definitely a muscle relaxant. So your stomach is part of your muscle system. Is there ever a reason for alcohol to ever be useful as maybe a prescribing product?
Here's the circumstances. Alcohol's like Valium. They're wonderful agents for relaxation. Valium is a fabulous muscle relaxant. The problem is you don't want to use it for a long time because your body pushes back. And that's one of my Dr. Don mantras, is the body pushes back. So if you expose it to alcohol every day, then you'll need a little bit, you might get into a situation where part of your brain wants a little bit more every day, and before you know it, you've got a problem. And in the case of drugs like Valium, the same thing happens. So daily use needs to be very, very moderate for alcohol, and we have plenty of cultural evidence that people can get away with one or two glasses or drinks a day for 50 years and not really suffer any damage. Here's a good one. I was going to talk about this, so you've brought it up. This was a study done on people who were asked to smoke 3 cigarettes after drinking a cup of red wine. They say a titrated volume, but it turns out it's 3 ounces. And they measured all kinds of blood factors for inflammation. So the white blood cell count, the leukocytes went up, the neutrophils went up, the lymphocytes went down, the platelet aggregate, all the stuff that's bad got worse after smoking, unless you had had that alcohol ahead of time. And if you'd had that glass of alcohol before you smoked the 3 cigarettes, Nothing bad happened in your bloodstream. Nothing. So would there be a reason to maybe, I'm not suggesting smoking, but I am suggesting that moderate alcohol, and we do mean moderate, like a half a glass of wine for a woman, a glass of wine for a man, particularly red wine, seems to have enough good stuff in it that the little hit from the alcohol is negligible and the benefit is great. So,
but there has been definitely a shown effect by somebody I'm not going out saying people should drink alcohol, but there has been shown an effect, and a lady called up about cardiovascular earlier, a definite effect.
Benefit, yes. There's clear benefit in frequency of heart attacks for moderate drinkers. And it's protective from the inflammatory effects of food. So if you drink, when you eat, if you drink some alcohol, and red wine is the strongest effect, then the inflammation that is always generated, always, always when you eat, but even by great good food, you'll get some inflammation. That goes away. So I hope that's covered it, and we need to go now, but thank you so much for the call. Bye-bye. So I wanted to share this with you. I thought this was fascinating, at least. Barium enema, which is when you put a contrast material into the rectum for diagnostic purposes generally, is a fairly common procedure. This is done, for example, if you're having a CT scan of the abdomen with contrast, there might be rectal contrast given to improve the visualization. It's very important. And we've always medically thought it not to have any downside risk. Statistics are amazing. So when you get big enough groups, things that looked like coincidences turn out to be trends. In this case, the Taiwan National Health Insurance Research Database, a total of 24,000, almost 25,000 patients who had barium enemas over a decade were enrolled in a cohort, and what they found was astonishing. In the first 2 months of a barium enema, for whatever reason, the risk of an acute appendicitis went up tenfold. The hazard ratio was 9.72. 10 times more people in that first 2 months had barium enemas. When you looked overall, the risk wasn't that great. It was about 1.2, so not a huge risk, 1.2 per 1,000 patient years. And the adjusted risk ratio was about 50% more in the barium enema cohort. Appendicitis is not an uncommon disease, but that 10 times in the first two months, that's huge. And we doctors need to know that. Clinicians, and also anyone out there who has rectal contrast and then develops pain in the right lower quadrant, even if you are 60 years old, when appendicitis is not going to be the first thing your doctor thinks about. I want it to be the first thing you think about. If you have barium rectally, you need to make sure your physician checks you for appendicitis if you develop nausea, vomiting, and abdominal pain. Have them get that spiral CT and check your appendix. Got an email here from Alouette in Quebec. Alouette has written to me before. Thanks for following us over to KSCO, Alouette. She writes, I've just read a long article about diet and was struck by the amount of bacterial that is clearly incorporated in these very healthy people's diet. Thought you might find it interesting. And she sent me an article from the westonpriced.org website. Talking about the diet of Mongolia, and the Mongolians drink a fermented milk, sort of a yogurt-like substance, and they have, of course, a lot of yogurt as well. This probiotic-rich diet is associated with an improved immune system, greater resistance to disease, and much lower risks of biological colon cancers. Fiber I mentioned before, but probiotics, live on fiber, so probably some of that health benefit from the quote-unquote undigestible fiber that we encourage people to consume. Well, let's just put it this way. There's a trillion bacteria in your gut going, indigestible, says who? And chowing down on that stuff. And if you eat the right bacteria chow, well, you get the right bacteria. I like to use the metaphor of a garden. Now, visualize a vacant lot. And now we're going to bring some people into that vacant lot, and they're going to cart out all the garbage. But if they don't do anything else, you'll have a bunch of thistle and a bunch of weeds. Well, now what you've got to do is you've got to cut down the thistle and the weeds, and you've got to turn the soil over, and you've got to put in some fertilizer. You've got to create the environment that the things that you want to grow in that garden need to survive and thrive. And I'm suggesting that we all need to become our own personal gut gardener. And that means the types of fiber that good bacteria like. And that, my friends, is your old friends, the fruits and vegetables. So even if you're a super taster and all vegetables taste bitter to you, well, figure it out. Try to eat fruits that are low sugar so that you get those bioflavonoids. Look for ways to consume things that are sweeter, like certain squashes or pumpkins, tomatoes. Try to get your vegetables, folks, one way or another, either in a pill or better, in a meal, because it's going to make a huge difference in your long-term health. And I just want to say to everyone who's listened that I am happy to have another hour with you, and I'll be back next month, the first Saturday of the month. Let me thank you so much for letting me be a part of your Saturday.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.